From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Libyans, or some of them, were scheduled to vote in elections Wednesday that would select the sixth new government in the past 2.5 years since the overthrow of the Libyan government by Al-Qaeda and related groups with the support of a U.S.-led bombing campaign that lasted 9 months in 2011. RT's Paula Slyer reports.
It was a time when David Cameron and his allies paraded the Libyan revolution as a win for Western democracy.
People in Britain, salute your courage. And while we are proud of the role that we played to help, we know this was your revolution from your bravery.
A time when Tony Blair's handshake with Colonel Gaddafi was conveniently forgotten. And maybe now the British Prime Minister might want to forget that the Libyan democratic project did not turn out quite as planned.
Post-Gaddafi Libya is a chaotic and violent state without political stabilization, without internal security for its people, without security in its borders.
The parliamentary election is underway, but the hand of law seems very far away. 2 months ago, parliament was overrun by gunmen. Jihadist militias and gangsters have taken over the streets. As the climate of fear intensifies, a growing number of Libyans look to General Khalifa Haftar as their savior. His supporters see him as the only man capable of crushing radical armed groups and building a national army. The U.S. exile has promised to rid the country of foreign fighters, and with strong links to Egypt's new president, Washington considers him a CIA asset. But not content with meddling from afar, the United States has sparked outrage by seizing a Libyan citizen from Benghazi.
America came in and kidnapped a person. We might have different opinions about him. But this is a Libyan citizen, no matter who he is. They came in and kidnapped someone from Benghazi.
But America is saying nothing.
America is not responsible for what happened in Libya, nor is it responsible for what's happening in Iraq today.
Western powers were quick to praise themselves for their initial efforts in Libya, and just as fast to disavow all responsibility. In Benghazi, the bombed-out ruins from General Haftar's last offensive are still smoldering. Libyans are frustrated, but feel powerless, even with voting slips in their hands. The last time they had a revolution, it did not turn out so well. Paula Slyer, RT.
According to reports from people inside Libya, turnout Wednesday was so light as to be nearly non-existent. We spoke with a Libyan woman who, for reasons of security for herself and her family in Tripoli, would identify herself only as Al-Fata 69. She spoke about the election and conditions in Libya before and after the U.S.-NATO war that destroyed her country. We'll bring you that interview later in this newscast. More finger-pointing by NATO over the unrest in Ukraine. We have this report from Press TV.
NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen says that Russia has failed to live up to its international commitment over Ukraine.
Russia's aggression against Ukraine led to the suspension of our practical cooperation. And I regret to say that we see no signs that Russia is respecting its international commitments. So today we will review our relations with Russia and decide what to do next.
Rasmussen made the comments ahead of a meeting of NATO foreign ministers. He added that the alliance reserves the right to grow larger. In a clear reference to Russia, Rasmussen said no other country will be allowed to prevent NATO's expansion. Moscow has already warned NATO against expanding further near its borders.
On Wednesday, the Ukrainian foreign ministry said in a press statement that NATO's secretary general presented a plan by the alliance to bolster Ukraine's defense capabilities during a meeting with the Ukrainian foreign minister, Pavel Klimkin. The statement said that the plan contained, quote, further practical steps aimed at enhancing the defense capabilities of Ukraine and improving its armed forces and security sector, closed quote. From the eastern region of Ukraine, the parliament of the newly proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic, or DPR, passed a constitutional act forming a confederation with the neighboring Luhansk People's Republic, or LPR. The DPR said on its official website and via Twitter, quote, the DPR Supreme Soviet passed a constitutional act on the unification of the DPR and LPR on a confederative basis into the Union of People's Republics, closed quote. Approval of a list of DPR deputies to the Parliament of the Union of the People's Republics was also announced. The DPR and LPR proclaimed independence from Kiev after the May 11th referendum on self-determination. On May 24th, the two republics signed a treaty on the creation of the Union of the People's Republics under the name of Novorossiya. Meanwhile, the leaders of Russia, France, Germany, and Ukraine spoke together in a conference call Wednesday about the extension of the current ceasefire between Ukrainian government forces and militias in the east of the country, which is set to expire Thursday. Presidents Vladimir Putin, François Hollande, and Pyotr Poroshenko, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel had, quote, detailed exchanges of opinions on the crisis situation in Ukraine, closed quote, according to the Russian president's office. According to various other reports, Merkel suggested that the tripartite contact group, consisting of Ukraine's former president, Leonid Kuchma, the personal representative for the OSCE chairperson in office, Heidi Tagliavini, and Russian ambassador to Ukraine, Mikhail Zurabov, should continue talks June 26th and, according to the press office of the Ukrainian head of state, the parties have agreed to do so. As if drones, satellites, and tracking devices to thwart al-Qaeda in Pakistan were not enough, the CIA was also once considering marketing Osama bin Laden demon dolls. Yep, you heard it right. RT's Maria Portnaya reports.
The toy market is a lucrative industry, generating a reported $84 billion in global revenue. And it makes sense. Everywhere around the world, toys generally make kids happy. Except when the CIA gets involved. According to the Washington Post, the spy agency concocted a plan in 2005 to develop Osama bin Laden demon dolls aimed at scaring children and their parents. The goal? To instill fear in families that would cause them to turn away from the real terrorist. The 12-inch figurines were painted with a heat-dissolving material designed to peel off and reveal a red-faced demon-like creature with piercing green eyes and black facial markings. The code name for the project was Devil Eyes. The plan was to distribute the toys to children in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where the CIA was trying to win hearts and minds. The CIA claims only three prototypes were developed before the project was canceled. However, a source tells the Washington Post that hundreds of bin Laden demon action figures were developed and sent to Karachi in 2006. Although the CIA did not move forward with the covert operation, one of the creepy demon figures reportedly remains at the agency's headquarters. Reporting from Washington, D.C., Marina Portnaya, RT.
Longtime observers of African politics point to the 2010 forced removal of the president of Cote d'Ivoire as marking the beginning of the current wave of the recolonization of the continent. Incumbent President Laurent Gbagbo had faced a former senior deputy of the International Monetary Fund, former Prime Minister Alassane Ouattara, in a runoff election November 28, 2010. The election was close, and although both sides claimed victory, Gbagbo was declared the winner in accordance with Article 94 of the Ivorian Constitution by the country's highest authority, the Constitutional Council. Western countries, including the U.S. and the country's former colonial power, France, refused to recognize the court's decision, and in April of 2011, after months of fighting, Gbagbo was removed from the presidential palace at gunpoint by French troops in U.N. uniforms. U.N. troops, operating as the United Nations Operation in Cote d'Ivoire, or ONUCI, have been on the ground since the end of the Ivorian Civil War in 2003. They remain there, and as Sophie Outhwaite reports, they apparently intend to leave a legacy behind.
The establishment of a force which can respond quickly to conflict situations in Cote d'Ivoire and across West Africa will be one of the United Nations' greatest legacies to the country. That's according to the top UN envoy in the country. The Quick Reaction Force is currently staffed with French troops, but comes under the command of the UN Force Commander. Once the UN leaves the country, it is envisaged that regional organisations like the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, may wish to continue to develop a similar quick reaction force as part of the developing regional security architecture. The UN Secretary-General's Special Representative in the country, Aishatu Mindaudu, says the force will play an important role in the future security of the region. Côte d'Ivoire is recovering from violence that followed disputed presidential elections in 2010.
The reconciliation process is moving ahead. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission's mandate has been extended. So they were working to the hearing of the victims. And in September, normally they must submit the report to the head of state.
What is the mission strategy now with regards to security?
Yes, with regard to the border with Liberia. You know, we have settled an intermission cooperation with the sister mission in Liberia, ANMIL. So our militaries and police were working together to really assess the situation and then to bring solution to any threat on the border.
Now, the mission has started to scale down its military component. What are the next steps, especially given the upcoming 2015 presidential elections?
By the end of May, we have reduced our troop by 1,700 as requested by the Security Council. And then we will also reduce by 1,100 by June 2015. So what our military did is that they reorganized the force. They have initiated a new concept of operation. And this new concept of operation will make our troops more dynamic because now they are static. So we are organizing the troops to be able to intervene in any area of Côte d'Ivoire within 12 hours. So this is the first aspect. The second aspect is related to this quick reaction force. The quick reaction force will be settled also in ONUSI. It will be part of ONUSI troop. And the most important fact to underline here is that it would be the very first time that a UN mission will leave a kind of legacy, because we will discuss it with ECOWAS, will be the core element for the quick react for the regional reaction force of ECOWAS in the future when the mission will leave the country.
Do you think Côte d'Ivoire is ready to hold presidential elections next year?
Yes, Côte d'Ivoire is ready to hold the elections, but you know those 2015 elections are very important for that country because it would be the very first time after the crisis that Côte d'Ivoire would be organizing presidential elections. So it is a very important milestone for the country. It is also important for all the Ivorians to work together to create a kind of conducive environment to hold a free, fair, and democratic elections. So with regard to the government, they have to create really the conditions of a kind of inclusivity to guarantee that all the processes which would be implemented should involve everybody, all the parties of the country should be involved in it. So with regard to the opposition, they have also to be committed, because I think for all the Ivorians now, they are convinced that war wouldn't be the solution. But they have to sit down together, to discuss together, and then to try to find all together the solutions to the problems they were facing. And one of the way of doing that is really to discuss together and then to find all together which will be the structure which would guarantee free, fair, and transparent elections.
It is unclear how long the UN mission, ONUSI, will remain. Its mandate is expected to be extended by the Security Council on Wednesday. Sophie Outhwaite, United Nations.
Both sides in the fighting in Iraq stand accused of carrying out summary executions and other acts in violation of international law. That, according to the Special Representative of the Secretary General in Iraq, Nikolai Mladenov, who confirmed that since early June, at least 1,300 civilians have been killed and 1,250 wounded in the conflict. Mladenov, who was also head of the UN Assistance Mission for Iraq, has called on the Iraqi authorities to swiftly investigate these allegations.
I have to begin where it all started. Since the fall of Mosul, the Islamic state of Iraq and the Levant, ISIL, has taken control over large swaths of Iraq's predominantly Sunni provinces, Nineveh, Salah ad-Din, Diyala, and some parts of Anbar that was already under the hands of ISIL and now out of the control of the government. Large cities, including Mosul, Tikrit, Tal Afar, Beji, Sinjar, and a number of other places, including Fallujah and Zaqlawiya, and most of Ramadi, have also fallen under the control of the armed opposition groups. In the areas that are controlled by ISIL, we are witnessing the implementation of Sharia law. However, the enforcement of that law, it varies from place to place. We have seen a number of reports of summary mass executions of Shia members of the Iraqi army and displacement of Shia and minority civilians. Summary executions have been also targeting prisoners, mainly in Diyala province. In addition to this, we have seen the Kurdish regional government deploying Peshmerga troops into areas that are considered to be disputed, including some army bases, and they are now fully in control of the city of Kirkuk. The Iraqi army has been under severe criticism for abandoning its posts and weapons, and this criticism has been universal across the board. And some political leaders have vowed even to take this to prosecute these crimes to the full extent of the law. On June 11th, Prime Minister Maliki called for volunteers to fight alongside with the armed forces, and a couple of days afterwards, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani issued a fatwa calling for volunteers to also fight ISIL. His call was aimed at people joining the armed forces, being trained and integrated into the armed forces before fighting those the terrorist groups. However, we have also witnessed the formation and the mobilization of various militias willing to take on ISIL, and some various reports of their numbers. This has, however, raised some concerns as to the sectarianization of this conflict since its beginning. Regionally, as you, I'm sure, well aware, this conflict could become quite easily a sectarian war between neighbors that have taken up quite firm positions as to what is happening here in Iraq. That danger has not been overcome at this point. UNAMI has verified incidents of ISIL executing captured police officers, soldiers, and civilians. We have also received a number of reports of abductions by ISIL of members of different religious and ethnic groups, such as the Shabaks, the Yazidi, and the Turkoman. In fact, that is an increasingly important concern for us as the minority groups fall right in the pathway of the conflict in the north of this country.
ISIL has been branded a terrorist organization by the UN Security Council. Meanwhile, the New York Times reported late Wednesday that American officials said Iran is flying unarmed surveillance drones over Iraq from an airfield in Baghdad and is secretly supplying Iraq with military equipment, an effort that appears to be directed by the head of Iran's paramilitary Quds Force. The Iranian moves come as the United States has deployed the first of as many as 300 military advisors of its own to Iraq. U.S. officials said that the American and Iranian military moves are not coordinated. The U.S. and Iran both oppose ISIS, also known as ISIL, but, according to the Times, they are still competing for influence in Iraq. Iran and the U.S. are backing opposite sides in the war in Syria, where ISIS is joined in the fight against the government by a number of groups backed by the U.S. Sukant Chandan is a political commentator and maintains a blog site, Sons of Malcolm. He spoke with Press TV's Omaleski about some of the background to the current situation in Iraq.
Mr. Chandan, do you think that the Obama administration is taking, a lot of caution and the right path by starting to send 300 advisors but not directly getting involved as of yet?
In order to understand what is actually going on, to go beyond the fog of war, the deceit and the double dealing that's ever present in the mainstream media, I think a simple question has to be asked. And the simple question is, who benefits the most? Who benefits the most from ISIL's activity and similar, what I call just death squads, basically, sectarian death squads. Who benefits from this? Now, the United States and Britain and France are in direct alliance with similar forces in Syria as they were in Libya, which the top came off on that issue way back in February 2011, when all these people who are known broadly under the umbrella term Al-Qaeda, we were told that they're the existentialist terrorist threat to the West, and suddenly the West is deeply embedded and in bed with them in relation to a regime change operation against a resistant global South country, which was the Jamhuriya of Libya, and then the open alliance on Syria. So really, on Iraq, who benefits the most? Now, whereas I would agree that these sectarian death squads are definitely a part of the disturbances we've been seeing for the last couple of weeks in Iraq, there's other forces at work here which are sometimes in an uneasy alliance and sometimes has antagonism. And basically, that's the members of the former ruling party in Iraq and the Saddam Hussein, that's the Ba'ath Party, who are also involved in the disturbances in the towns and cities impacted. So really, the question has to be, who benefits from this situation? Now, clearly, I think the United States and Britain and France benefit, in as much as that basically it opens up a buffer area for the death squads in Syria to develop their capacity. And we already are hearing in the Financial Times today in London of US Humvees being used by the death squads taken from Iraq and used into Syria. Also, it draws in Iran in a very sophisticated operation to soften it up, because Iran still at the end of the day is targeted for war by London, Paris, and Washington and the white settler Zionist state, and several other strategic things which are to the benefit of the United States and Britain and not to their detriment.
According to reports from people inside Libya, turnout in Wednesday's election was so light as to be nearly non-existent. We spoke with a Libyan woman who, for reasons of security for herself and her family in Tripoli, would identify herself only as Al-Fatah 69 in commemoration of the 1969 revolution that installed the government of Muammar Gaddafi. She spoke about the election and conditions in Libya before and after the U.S.-NATO war. So, Al-Fatah 69, mm-hmm. Which is, of course, a reference to the 1969 Libyan Revolution,
exactly.
Is your handle. And can you tell us, first of all, your connection to Libya?
Well, I am Libyan, born and raised. I lived there till I was 24. And then I started going back and forth between Libya and Europe. Hmm. And I was planning to go back for permanent stay in 2011, before the illegal war. Hmm. That is about it. But I've never left Libya, actually. I've been in touch. I mean, I've been in and out practically every 2-3 months.
And you have family too there, right?
So. I have a big family, a lot of relatives, and as you know, Libyans usually they have about, each family has about 5-6 kids, and that goes on. I practically have over 50 first cousins.
Wow, that's almost like an Italian family. I have 36 first cousins.
Yeah. And that is only the side of my dad's.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the side of my mom's.
Wow. So maybe give our listeners first just a little taste of what Libya was like before 2011, because they have a very distorted picture of what it's like.
I can imagine. Libya till February 2011 was a paradise, especially for women. Had the best security available. She could go out. She could stay out till 2-3 o'clock in the morning and not be harassed or asked why she's out. She could dress practically like a European. With a small, you couldn't wear strapless, for example. A Libyan couldn't do that. But that was out of respect, not because if she wanted to, she could do it. That's beside the point. Very prosperous. Practically everybody was rich. Not filthy rich, but rich. Mm. We had something like a 5% poverty line. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, but statistically, that was it. When Gaddafi took over in 1969, we had over 85% of they didn't know how to read and write. And he issued a law, which I remember at that time, that everybody, small kids and older people, had to go to school. They had to learn to read and write. It was unacceptable that they would put a fingerprint as a sign, as a signature. So he educated everybody, free education, free health care. On free education, we will take one piece. After you finished high school, you'd go to university. Now, if you wanted a specialty, which was master's, doctorate, or whatever, this was on the government. They would send you wherever in the world you wanted. They would pay your school fees, your university fees. They would rent you an apartment, and they would give you also pocket money so you didn't need to work for the time that you're studying.
As opposed to the huge pile of student debt you get in the United States.
Exactly.
Let me ask you going forward. So the election will be over today, and that will be that. And if the past is any indication, whoever ends up being foreign minister will be lucky to get out of the country with their life in a month or so. What do you see going forward? What has to be done to remedy the situation in Libya?
Get rid of Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, and Al-Sharia. And after that, the tribes will fix the country.
Is anyone working on that project, do you know?
Well, as far as I know, the tribes in Egypt, they are working on it.
Good.
Because those are the leaders. They are the leaders. They are the ones who are doing what they're doing. But we, none of the, let me explain it this way, Don. All Libyans, except Derna, they are not fanatic Muslims. They are not extremists. We were very, I would say, half European. We would do our Ramadan, we would respect our elders, everything that that Muslim religion says, but not to the extent that now has been brought on us. I'll give you an example. My cousin was a very liberated man. That was till 2010. Since 2011, after the war and everything, he has his wife with a burqa, has his girls with a burqa, and they stay home.
Yeah, well, given the conditions, actually, that may not be an inappropriate response, because if they go out, not everyone has security like you do to go out.
Exactly. No, I understand him. I'm not criticizing him. I'm just saying the result,
right.
What happens.
It's an enforced conformity.
Exactly.
By terror.
Exactly. So unless we get rid of these people and we get them out of our country and we get the colonizers out of our country, there will never be peace in Libya. That I guarantee it.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.